This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Indecision. Overthinking. Second-guessing every choice you make. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Beige on beige on beige. Ugh. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Looking to improve your diet in the new year? Try seeing a personal dietitian with Nourish. Nourish has hundreds of dietitians who specialize in a variety of health concerns, including weight loss, gut health, and more. Meet with your dietitian online and message them anytime through the Nourish app. Nourish accepts hundreds of insurance plans. 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Find your personal dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Another nice spring day out there, and I'm going to tell you what, I keep saying it over and over, you better get out and enjoy it, because before you know it, it's going to be hot and humid in summertime. Highs today is 75. Tomorrow, 79, 77 Friday, a little cooler than perfect for the French Quarter Fest, 75 on Saturday, 79 on Sunday. Then we're back to the 80s for most of next week. But as we approach Mother's Day, that's usually the first real sock in the nose that we get about the heat and humidity of summertime. So the Bratton Report is out from Teneo Consultants. And I'm quoting from a story here at NOLA.com by Sophie Kazikov, Ben Myers, and Jeff Adelson. They quoted the report by saying, consultants at global consulting firm Teneo, including former New York City and L.A. Police Commissioner William Bratton, found that staffing levels, resource allocation and distribution, availability of critical infrastructure, protective barriers, and communication inefficiency challenged the NOPD's ability to address the growing threats against the city. And when I read that phrase, the first thing I thought of was, man, the city's got a lot of threats that are that the city is challenging, whether it's insurance, whether it's flood protection, et cetera, this just being a part of them. But let's talk about the things that the Bratton Report mentioned, and Glade Bilby joins us now to give us his opinion, president of the French Quarter Citizens. How you doing, Glade?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The French Quarter, not really prone to flooding. That's not a concern for the French Quarter itself, but the city overall, absolutely. Let's talk about what this Bratton report said. 43 pages, rather. I don't know if you had time to read the whole thing, but some of your takeaways from it and your reaction to it.
Well, we've talked about pedestrianization, if you will, which is closing off some of the streets for some years now. I don't know if you recall, but when Kristen Palmer was council person for our district here, they wanted to close off certain parts. Well, there was a lot of uproar about it. There was a lot of problems because we have, although it's small, we do have a residential community here that needs to come and go. And closing off things makes it very difficult. On the other hand, there is a practicality to closing off some of the quarter. But the reality is we have 19 million, over 18 million tourists, let's say. And that's a lot of infrastructure burden. You have to get people in. You have to get luggage in. You have to get supplies, liquor in. You have to clean the place all the time. And that's just not a good weekend. That's all the time. So you really have to think about access on a 24/7, 365 basis.
So as far as the Bratton recommendations, possible or practical or not?
Well, I don't think that it's practical. Think about the number of people that come to Bourbon Street. It's not now, this morning, early, but it starts mid-morning, and it culminates probably 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. You've got to clean that all the time. I think maybe there's a window you could keep it closed, but as some of the report says, you have to be effective at doing it. You have to do cross-department communication that works well, and I don't know that we're necessarily ready for that. But the other thing is, it's the French Quarter. It's not just Bourbon Street. So unless you close off the entire French Quarter, you're going to really have a hard time protecting it.
Tell me about French Quarter Fest and the plans that they put into place as were revealed. We talked to Colin Arnold about it yesterday. Do you think that's going to affect your thoughts on that, I guess, Glenn, because there's a couple of different things. I want to get your thoughts overall on French Quarter Fest and what you'd like to remind people as they head into the French Quarter, and also how much of an inconvenience is that going to be to you, and are you okay with that kind of thing for the French Quarter Festival?
Well, if it happened every weekend, it would be problematic. But to have, as they did last year, 900,000 people come into your neighborhood, which is almost three times the size of the city, is certainly a logistical challenge. But I think some of the barricades I've seen are in place already. There's certainly a way to, let's say, manage the number of people. One of the things overall in any of the situations that they do, whether it's French Quarter Fest or on a weekly basis, you have to have some sort of traffic coordination plan in place because everybody can't drive down here. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness you're hearing them ask you to take Uber, park somewhere else. You can't put all the cars here. It's one thing to have people, but you can't put the transportation that goes with the people in the same place. So that's really an issue, is logistics.
It's been about 5 years since I've gone, and the last time I did go, maybe even longer than that, it was almost like Bourbon Street on Mardi Gras Day throughout most of the quarter, where you were like moving through people. Excuse me, if I could just let me pass by, thank you. I mean, is it that bad, Glade?
It lessens the quality of the experience when you have that many people. I've suggested split French Quarter Fest up to four certain times during the year when you could use that. It wouldn't be so burdensome on the infrastructure here, not when it's a Saints game or other things where you're going to have a lot of people down here. But don't make it one big, giant four-day event, and that might be better. But it is not quite as interesting as it was when it first started. Because it was smaller, as everything you see, when people discover it, it becomes overwhelmed.
It goes from being a best-kept secret to a major pain in the gula. So do you think it's gotten too big as a resident and the president of the French Quarter citizens? Do you think it has gotten too big and maybe it's time the city revisits it and maybe splits it up to four different weekends? If not throughout the year, then maybe in a month or something like that? Thoughts?
Well, it certainly dissolves. We need some discussion about that because it is big. And when you just have people flowing like the tide, you see the music and you get to stand in line for a while to get something. But I think the quality of it, at a certain point, the quality of the experience becomes something you have to consider and not just an event to go to.
Is this something you dread every year, kind of like the residents of Mid-City do with Jazz Fest?
Well, I don't dread it necessarily, but I think that...
You don't sound like you're looking forward to it.
No, not particularly. No.
I noticed some parsing of the words there, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, Glade, but I can hear something in your voice, and it's not excitement.
It's not excitement. It's good for a lot of people. It's not necessarily the best experience to go to for me, for sure.
All right, somebody texted in, and I want to talk about this when we come back. Yeah, sure, people may die, but at least tourists won't have to walk a block with their luggage. I think what people need to keep in mind is if this sick individual doesn't decide to do what he did on New Year's Day, none of this is happening. I don't think it is, but we can address that. We come back. 621 traffic now, WWL. 627, call it. Back with Glade Bilby, president of French Quarter Citizens, talking about the Bratton Report and their recommendations and how Glade feels about it as a resident of the French Quarter. We have also touched on French Quarter Fest. So, Glade, you know, somebody texted in about, let me see if I can pull it up here again, something about, it's a little, yeah, sure, people may die, but at least tourists won't have to walk a block with their luggage. Your thoughts on, as a resident of the Quarter and what happened on New Year's Day, if one sick individual doesn't choose to perpetrate this attack, we're not having any of these conversations or any of this conversation at all. So do you think it's an overreaction? You understand where I'm coming from here? Because it was one act by one person. It exposed the vulnerability, but there are a lot of vulnerabilities. Thoughts?
There are a lot of vulnerabilities, and if one person wanted to do something, you could do it on Decatur, you could do it on Royal Street, you could do it on Canal Street. It wouldn't necessarily be limited to Bourbon Street. And when you think about walking, go to the airport. You probably walk two blocks before you get to your plane. I don't think anybody's going to be able to park right at their hotel, at their front door. There's going to be a certain inconvenience that comes along with safety. And I think doing this in a practical level will be better. It will maybe deter people. And I think that's where just everyday law enforcement comes in, where you don't give people the idea that you can do anything you want to do. Yeah, I know last year you and I talked about illegal vending and a lot of the things that were going on Bourbon Street. And fortunately, they were able to kind of enforce the law, and that's decreased quite a bit. We've had fairly good success with a reactive 8th District police force, where we've decreased crime in the French Quarter and the 8th District, which includes Superdome and Canal Street and the CBD. So I think just doing normal police work is going to certainly help deter something go forward. But again, the individual can do anything they want at almost any given time. Not necessarily on Bourbon, but somewhere. Doesn't have to be Bourbon Street.
So maybe an overreaction?
Well, yes, I would think so. But they do need to put some kind of safety precautions in place so people feel safe. You're not going to come here if you don't feel safe.
But again, so, if that one person doesn't do that on New Year's Day, I'm just trying to keep it real and factual. We're not having any of these conversations, are we?
No, we're not. No, we're not. But we were blocking people off from going onto Bourbon Street. There were barricades on certain things for special events. So we were doing something. It maybe wasn't as onerous or as encompassing as what they're recommending in this report.
Thank you, Glade. Appreciate your time and your insight, Glade Bilby, president of French Quarter Citizens. We'll take a break. We come back. We're talking to Mike Pearlstein about the specific recommendations of the Bratton Report. Right now, time for WWL First News. Anyway, years from now, you go to City Park and you wonder, well, how did it turn out this way? Anyway, so you say, who decided to do this? Well, you got nobody to blame but yourself if you don't get involved in a planning process, which is going on now. Rebecca Dietz joins us, president and CEO of City Park Conservancy. How are you doing, Rebecca?
I'm doing well. How are you this morning?
I'm okay. Tell me, am I wrong about that? Where now's the time to speak up if you want a voice in what City Park is going to look like?
That's correct. City Park has launched a master planning process. This will inform and guide investment in the park over the next 20, 25 years. And we're asking the entire community to join us.
Tell me what you're looking. When is the event? First of all, I think it's tonight, right?
Yes, actually, we're hosting two sessions of a community design meeting today. This is our third community meeting. It'll be held at the Pavilion of Two Sisters in City Park. And again, we have two sessions today. Doors open at 11:30.
Right. Forget about the morning.
That's right, 11:30 today, and then again at 6 o'clock. People can also pre-register on the website so we have an idea of how many people will attend.
So what are you looking for? What should people come with? What should they? What are you looking for people to contribute, et cetera?
Well, today's meeting is especially exciting and important because we're going to be showing design concepts that directly reflect what we've heard from park users over the past year and a half of planning. These meetings have built on each other. And what we have heard from the community is what will be reflected in the plan. So if you have input, if you have more ideas, now's the time to come and share them with us. And if you've not been involved in the process thus far, today would be a great day to show up.
Is it open to Orleans Parish residents only?
Oh, absolutely not. This park serves the entire region, and we welcome anyone who loves City Park or anyone who has ideas about how it can be better in the future to come and join us.
What have you heard so far from people, some of the suggestions? I'm just curious.
Oh, sure. We've heard a great deal about improving and increasing access to nature, restoring our lagoon system and native Louisiana landscapes, restoring and investing in historic buildings such as Tad Gormley Stadium. We've also heard that we need more access to sports facilities, boating opportunities, activities for young people beyond just playgrounds. And also, not surprisingly, we've also heard that the community just wants us to have more basic park amenities such as lighting, water fountains, restrooms, parking.
I took a hike on the, the Scout Trail? Is that the name of it?
Scout Island, yes.
Scout, yeah. And it was pretty cool. It really was. It wasn't quite Gatlinburg or anything like that or the Tennessee Smoky Mountain National Park, but it was still nice. Tell me the website that people can go to, Rebecca.
It's NewOrleansCityPark.org.
All right. Meetings at 11:30 and 6 o'clock today. Go out, have your voice heard. 6:43, quick break, then we'll come back, talk to Mike Pearlstein about the Bratton Report here on WWL. All right, 6:48, quickly to Mike Pearlstein, WWL TV, Channel 4. Talk about the Bratton Report. Mike, how you doing?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. 44 pages, no time to discuss all of that. What jumped out to you in this report?
Well, of course, immediately the recommendation to turn the first 8 blocks of Bourbon Street into a pedestrian mall, permanent pedestrian mall. That is certainly going to generate some debate and discussion. We've seen it in some of the community meetings that business owners, residents, and others are going to push back on that. But it will be interesting to see how it plays out. Obviously, this report is, it's just recommendations. Doesn't necessarily mean the city is automatically going to adopt, many of the proposals. But that one is going to be a flashpoint.
I know I'm seeing stories here from The Advocate 2017. Landrieu administration wanted to bar vehicles for most of Bourbon Street. LaToya Cantrell wants to turn the French Quarter, other areas into pedestrian-only zones. That was 2020. Before the terrorist attack, it did happen on January 1st. Does the equation change at all, or are the same, even though there was this horrific event on January 1st, are there going to be the same opposition, I guess, as there was in 2017 and 2020?
Yeah, we've gotten kind of an early signal with a couple of the community meetings. One in the French Quarter was packed house, standing room only. So there will certainly be a lot of voices that need to be heard here. One thing that comes to mind is the fact that this proposal is 8 blocks, a little further than even what was restricted during, Super Bowl. And then after that, the full carnival leading up to Mardi Gras. But for those who ventured into the quarter and saw all the barricades and the checkpoints, during the course of Carnival, that's what's, being proposed here. Obviously, the details being left up to the city and the NOPD in particular. But look for some, pretty dramatic changes, and that's just the top of the list. The report includes a whole bunch of, other recommendations to some longstanding, practices and policies, like the NOPD deploys officers on parade routes, for example, in small clusters for, strength and backup. And the report says don't do that. And the report repeatedly hits the NOPD for being understaffed in a variety of ways, that being one of them. So the recommendation is to take those officers, sort of like, you know, take two-man cars and split them up into one-man cars to spread your visibility and footprint. We'll see if that happens. But the report recommends a single officer on a block rather than clusters of officers.
But yet, it doesn't NOPD say, and isn't it necessarily the opinion of law enforcement that NOPD does a great job when it comes to Mardi Gras, the way they handle it?
Oh, no doubt. And the fact that, you know, the NOPD is, you know, the lead agency for this massive open street celebration year in and year out. They have it down to a science. Other cities do, you know, study the New Orleans playbook on that. However, the terrorist attack changed everything. It pointed out the vulnerabilities. And in light of that, I guess, you know, the obvious question is, okay, what are the holes? How can they be plugged? And this is what this 43-page report does. And some of these, I think, will be pretty non-controversial and pretty obvious. For example, trash cans. Don't put them on the route. That could easily be a hiding place for an IED or bomb. Move portalettes off of the route, away from crowds. I think some of those things would, you know, be pretty easily implemented. Other things are going to be tough to not impossible, which is the repeated point that the NOPD is woefully understaffed and it barely has an intelligence unit to maybe, you know, act ahead of threats to neutralize them. So it will be interesting to see how this is digested once it finally gets, you know, kind of wide public dissemination, starting with, you know, the city council will be sure to have some kind of, you know, hearings regarding the pretty long list of proposals and recommendations.
So real quick, one thing, I didn't have a chance to read the entire report, but did it mention the fact that state law allows people to carry guns concealed in the French Quarter?
You know, it did not go into that. I think that's just the contours of, you know, how you have to patrol your major events. They deal with the primarily, you know, the threat similar to the terrorist attack or other people who would do harm. And, you know, the underlying, I guess, theme of the whole thing is where people gather in large groups. And we see that all along parade routes and all the way from, say, not just Bourbon, Jackson Square, Frenchman. And this report addresses that, you know, if the New Orleans wants to seal up the holes it has in security, it has to, you know, pay attention to those other vulnerable spots, and some quite historic. If you look at Jackson Square with St. Louis Cathedral and the Cabildo, if you want to take away the risk, and that is also, you know, what I guess is the balance in this report is, if the city is willing to absorb, you know, some risk, then you don't have to, you know, put up, say, barricades along Jackson Square. We've seen that the city has erred on the side of caution, and now go to Jackson Square. You will see, you know, the archer-type barricades, you know, all along the perimeter preventing vehicles from entering. So a lot of these measures have already been taken.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. I hope you can come back and discuss more of it when we have more time. 6:55. We'll talk about it more later on this morning as we discuss it with Aaron Holmes, Executive Director of the Vieux Carré Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. That's at 8:15. Right now, traffic, WWL. Another beautiful spring day. I can't urge you enough to get out and enjoy it if you can, while you can, because the heat and humidity of summer will be here before you know it. Sherry Tenpenny, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, I don't know what kind of doctor she is, prominent anti-vaccine activist who once claimed during a legislative hearing in Ohio that the COVID vaccine could cause patients to become magnetized, allowing them to, quote, stick spoons and forks all over their bodies, is not happy that RFK Jr. is now saying that they should get the measles vaccine. The only reason I wanted to quote that story from NPR is because you got to consider the source. It's Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, a vaccine anti-vaxxer, claimed that the COVID vaccine could cause you to become magnetized and you could stick spoons and forks all over you, which I don't know that that's ever happened. Dr. Corey Hebert joins us now, he's the associate professor of pediatrics at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine, and he is on WWL as well. How you doing, Dr. Corey?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Let's talk about this reversal by RFK Jr. And I was mentioning earlier, unfortunately, you know, that's why libel suits are sometimes can be successful, because you can retract it all you want. But once you say something, the retraction hardly gets the notice that the original statement does. Let's talk about RFK Jr. and the measles vaccine.
Yeah, I had to stalk you a little bit yesterday because I did the story on this reversal that RFK made. And the problem is that in government, in health, we have to follow science and we have to stay out of politics. And that's a excuse me. I don't know what's wrong with me.
I'll tell you what it is, that oak pollen. It's that oak pollen is what it is.
Yeah,
doctor, I would prescribe a Benadryl.
Yeah, exactly. I hope it's not the measles. The issue becomes, you know, this whole time, you know, we have known throughout the last 50, 60 years that the measles is a very contagious disease. We know that, you know, it can cause subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. It can cause you to have a horrible high fevers. It can cause pneumonia, all these types of things. And we know this. And then all it takes is a few people to be fringe and not scientists and come out to say, well, we don't think this is right. So that has been the stance of RFK and a few of his other really anti-vaxxer compadres. And, you know, if something is rare, that's one thing. And you can call it rare. But if it happens to you, it's 100%, right? It's kind of like winning the lottery. Yeah, winning the lottery is rare, but you buy a ticket, because if it happens to you, it's 100%. So when these things start to come to light, meaning you are in Texas and you're looking at the mother of a child who died, or you looking at one of the 481 people who have gotten ill, very ill, from this disease that we know has a vaccine preventable status, then you kind of have to look at yourself and say, what have I done? What really is happening here? And I think that he had to come to, I don't want to say Jesus, because he may be atheist, he may be Christian, I don't know, whatever his Jesus is, I think he had to have a come to Jesus moment, which we have all had.
Let's say common sense moment, doctor. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. And so his quote was, and I like to quote people. I'm not, you know, just talking about what I thought I may have interpreted. His quote was, the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles is the MMR vaccine. I've spoken to Governor Abbott. I've offered HHS's continued support. At his request, we have redeployed CDC teams to Texas, right? So when you have that now, when can you ever go back as a person who is ethical and who is trying to be the best politician that you can be and say, I'm an anti-vaxxer for measles, mumps, rubella? Who can do that? And I think that that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that you have to get to a point where you're like, this is real life, and it's not statistics, it's not play, it is science, and people, if you make bad decisions, people can and will die. And that's my biggest point I wanted to make today. You cannot just listen to people that are lawyers trying to sue people for a vaccine injury, even though I want to be very clear, because I know you're going to get a lot of texts about this. Vaccines prevent illness, but no medicine that you ever will has no side effects. Every medicine that you take could have a side effect, and that could be a vaccine. That could be one of the most serious killers of people in the world, which is Tylenol and Motrin. We pop them like Tic Tacs, but we never think about a disease you can get called Stevens-Johnson syndrome every time you take an ibuprofen. That can make you have such a serious reaction, your lips basically fall off, your skin falls off, and you die, right? So nobody talks about that. but that could happen every time you take one pill of Motrin and read the package insert if you don't believe me. And
can it develop right away, doctor? The reason I say that is to keep working out and stay active. I take a lot of ibuprofen. Would I have known by now if I was going to get that?
Generally, yes. But the way that the body works, Tommy, it's really interesting. You have heard people that weren't allergic to crawfish, and then all of a sudden as an adult they develop that allergy. These things, the body is an amazing thing, and so it's possible that you can develop Stevens-Johnson syndrome after you have been taking ibuprofen.
Well, you know what? We got to take a break here, doctor, and we'll pick it up here when we come back. I hope that doesn't happen, but I want to keep working out and I want to stay active, and my face isn't all that good anyway, so if it falls off, it falls off. 721 traffic now, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Dr. Corey Hebert, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. RFK Jr. has reversed his position on the measles vaccine. We already talked about this nut job doctor from Ohio, I think it is. She's a DO, a doctor of osteopathic medicine, that talked about the COVID vaccine making you magnetic and causing spoons to stick to you. While another physician, a Dr. Bowden from Texas, who lost her privileges at a hospital over prescribing patients ivermectin during the COVID pandemic, told NPR in an interview that Kennedy was one of those candidates that attracted people who might not vote for Trump. And the reason I bring that up, Dr. Hebert, is I don't know how, and this is an ENT, this is a physician, I don't know how logic, how politics can get in the way of science when it comes to medicine. And can you maybe address that for me, please?
You know, Tommy, I think that, you know, our world right now is an echo chamber. Was full of cognitive dissonance, and people, you know, have so much information. I think that the ability to obtain information has far outpaced our ability to understand and synthesize information, meaning that our brains get so much information now all day, every day, that you don't know what to believe. So just a few minutes ago, not to mix metaphors, I said something about a disease called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Uh-huh. And people are like, wait a minute, Stevens-Johnson syndrome? I've never heard of that. Oh, my God. And then I'm sure they may have Googled it, and they looked at the pictures and said, wow. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because as a physician, I've heard about that 1,000 times. But you're not a physician. So maybe you should not have heard of that, and maybe that's not something that's in your lexicon for you to be able to just pull out to talk about. But that's my job as a responsible physician to be able to give you that type of information. So if you go Google it, you'll go down the rabbit hole, and now you'll read the package insert on everything, tell all your family that they shouldn't take Motrin, and now everybody thinks that nobody should take Motrin. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I'm surprised that I've not heard more about that. Or maybe I will now, Doc. Not that it's your fault, but the question I had is how people are mad about COVID. I understand that. Maybe the government handled it right. Maybe they didn't with the shutdowns. I don't know. History will prove that out. But you can't conflate that with a measles vaccine, right? Just maybe talk people through that, if you will, about.
Yes. You have to look at the body of work of a person, or the body of work of a scientific group, or the body of work of anybody. Of any institution. You know, if the Saints had one player that was bad, you don't think that, you know, that the Saints as an institution is horrible forever, correct?
Right.
And so that's what you have to start thinking about when we start looking at the way that we responded to COVID, which was a very new thing that a lot of people made a lot of mistakes about. A lot of people did a lot of great things. But at this point, that has nothing to do with vaccines for all. It has nothing to do with us trying to be healthier as people. It has nothing to do with the scientific establishment saying that we have done very well in trying to prevent and continue to prevent disease. So that's what you must take every day differently when it comes to what you think or who you listen to, because these very revered sources of health information are the things that you need to be, the people you need to be listening to.
Doctor, thank you.
Not just people.
Thank you so much for
sir.
Your time. I hope we can enlighten people on this a little bit. And I'll see you and your lovely significant other at Salvo's soon, okay?
Oh, yes, sir.
All
I'll
right.
talk to you soon, my
you
friend.
Dr. Corey Hebert is eating some crawfish. couple of weeks ago, and who was sitting next to me? But Dr. Corey Hebert. 7:31, time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Beautiful spring day. Get out and enjoy it before the heat and humidity arrive. Susan Bourgeois joins us. The Secretary of Louisiana Economic Development, well, the Louisiana Economic Development Secretary. I messed up your title. Sorry about that, Susan. How are you?
No worries. I'm great. How are you this morning?
I'm okay. Tell me about the Louisiana Department of Economic, the Louisiana Economic Development Department, I guess is what it is.
Yeah, well, Louisiana Economic Development is the name of the agency. You know, I've been on the show many times, but all the time we're talking about either a specific project, a specific announcement, a specific win, which is great, too. The great thing about this one is I think we get to talk a little bit about the general direction of the department and where the state, through these efforts, are headed from an economic prosperity perspective.
Yeah, I'm sorry I messed up the title, but I wanted to just let people know what it is that you do and how actively you all work every day to try to bring industry and jobs to the state, right?
Right. No, I mean, absolutely. At the end of the day, our core mission as a state agency, but I always like to say that doesn't act like one, right, is to drive growth and opportunity for prosperity for Louisiana and its citizens. So, you know, that's sort of the overarching mission of what we do here.
So let's talk about this announcement, then we'll talk about other things, the ammonia announcement.
Yeah, well, I mean, yesterday, the irony is that we were going to talk about a strategic plan, but we keep having these wins in the meantime to interrupt it, which is a great problem to have, right?
Could be worse.
This was a project that was actually had been contemplated for about 4 or 5 years. Back in the previous administration, there had been an announcement that CF was considering this expansion. And, you know, we actively like to believe that treating capital and treating industry aggressively in a way that gets them here is what moved this from a contemplation phase to an action phase. And the announcement yesterday was that CF with some partner investors would be investing a little bit over $4 billion in a blue ammonia plant in Donaldsonville, very close to the Hyundai facility that we announced 2 weeks ago at the White House.
So tell me what was involved in getting this deal.
Well, I think, again, you know, there is a we keep hearing this. This was stated yesterday at the press conference and then even in private meetings between the company executives and the governor and myself. The truth is there is a welcome. There is a perception and a reality that Louisiana is open for and welcoming business right now, that we are creating an ease of use, if you will, to make it easy for companies to come here, invest, and ultimately be successful. Because when they're successful, Louisiana and our citizens are successful. And that just keeps getting repeated. So much of what, frankly, moved this project from that contemplation phase to the decision to invest the money and make it official was that ease of doing business and the state government and the whole of government wrapping their arms around the company to get it done.
So we're talking about 103, I think it is, permanent jobs with an average salary of $110,000. Those jobs, and my concern always is that people come from out of state and take those jobs, although Louisiana does need more population. I always think of the people here first. Who's likely to get these jobs? And take me through that, Susan, if you can.
Well, you know, I always say economic development, just like all politics, is local, right?
Right.
It starts that way. Our hope and expectation is it starts right in the Donaldsonville community where this investment is going on. Mm-hmm. You know, the announcement we made about Hyundai included a $30 million new training facility as part of the Louisiana Community and Technical College system. That facility is not just for Hyundai. It's for the West Bank of Ascension Parish and the people over there who want to get upskilled, reskilled, young people who want to get trained for these jobs. So first and foremost, we hope it comes immediately from the West Bank of Ascension Parish and the folks right there. But truth be told, with the sheer numbers of jobs that we're talking about adding in this region and in others, we do have wins happening all over the state right now, that there will be opportunities for people, again, upskilling, reskilling. But, you know, I don't want to get too much in my partner Susie Schauen's business on the Workforce Commission, but I will tell you the staggering statistic that folks in Louisiana should all be aware of is that it's not really our unemployment numbers that are a concern. Our unemployment numbers have been pretty consistently good for a long time now. The bigger concern is the number of people not participating in the workforce. Our workforce participation rate, which simply means the people who are of an age and are not disabled, so the people who are eligible for work, only about 60%, and that's a rough number, 58 to 60% of those people are actually working or looking for work. So a workforce participation issue is a really greater than the unemployment issue in Louisiana right now. This kind of opportunity gives us the momentum, the incentive, the emphasis on moving people from that not in the labor force into the labor force perspective.
All I would think all anybody could ask for is a well-paying, steady job, and that's, to me, what America is all about. We'll pick it up here. We come back, 752, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. Remember the Seinfeld episode, 758, Tommy Tucker, WWL, when Kramer says he kept making the stops because they kept ringing the bell? Well, we keep having Susan Bourgeois on, Louisiana Economic Development Secretary, because they keep announcing wins the latest, the blue ammonia plant on the West Bank of Ascension Parish. Susan, somebody texted, and I think this is a fair question, about have they signed on a line that is dotted, and how do you go from, or how, are we certain that Hyundai's going to break ground on this steel plant, that they're going to break ground on this blue ammonia plant, and what's the timeline on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, we are as certain as anyone can be in as it relates to private industry and what happens in the world. Mm-hmm. But so the CF project is slated to begin actually later this year, okay, construction, and Hyundai is slated to begin mid-year to third quarter of next year.
So real quick, let me just jump in real quick. Tariffs are on everybody's mind. Is that a concern of yours as it relates to attracting investment, either foreign or domestic?
It is not, for two reasons. Number one, what actually happens with all of that, where we land with all of them, and what the economic outcome of it is all very much speculative right now. So we're not changing our policy. That's why we did a strategic plan to put us on a path forward. And secondly, our partners with CF, actually a Japanese partner, said this in the press conference yesterday, that at the end of the day, if anything, it just encourages them to build and get here faster before the component parts get tariffed, because there are some tariffs attached to them. So people aren't stopping decisions. People, in fact, are, if anything, are perhaps making them faster.
Thank you. So the Braden Report is out. Teneo is the name of the company, about recommendations to keep the French Quarter in New Orleans secure. We had some conversations already with Glade Bilby, president of French Quarter Citizens, and Mike Pearlstein, WWL Louisiana investigative reporter. And one thing that kind of stuck out to me was that they talked about, when it comes to police protection, that during Mardi Gras, the police officers shouldn't accumulate in one place, that they should spread out and stand in different locations individually. But what strikes me about that is, for the longest time, other police departments and law enforcement agencies have looked at NOPD as the gold standard when it comes to crowd control and other things as it relates to Mardi Gras. So I don't know if that's contradictory or not. That's my opinion. Let's see what Aaron Holmes thinks, executive director of the Vieux-Carré Property Owners, Residents and Associates, VCPORA, about some of the things that have come out so far. How you doing, Aaron?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Tell me your thoughts on what you know of the Braden Report so far.
Well, it just came out yesterday. I think I got my hands on it around 5 o'clock, and so, of course, I went immediately to it to peruse it, and there weren't a lot of shockers there, because we were kind of anticipating the major point, which was to completely – the major recommendation, I should say, which is to completely pedestrianize Bourbon Street. But then there were some other interesting notes on how they plan on phasing out a more comprehensive securities package over, 6, 12, 18 months and situations like that. So I'm still getting into the details, but it's interesting.
So it's a little early for you to let me phrase it this way. Is there anything that you saw that that made you happy and excited and thought would be a good thing, or something conversely that made you think, oh, Lord in heaven, this is not going to work?
Well, I think this is a situation of managed expectations. I think, you know, this firm, Teneo, was hired to provide a recommendation. And I think that what they've done is provided a set of, you know, policy initiatives that, you know, if money were no option and if we had all the resources in the world, we could certainly do this. But I think that it doesn't take into account, you know, what it's going to take to fund things like that, the implementation, the logistics. It just says, here's a recommendation. Now it's up to you, New Orleans, to implement it. So I wasn't surprised. Definitely, we've been hearing that the recommendation was going to lead to a hard closure of Bourbon Street. And of all the meetings and conversations I've had.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet, and the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's. So thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy!
This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe, without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything, to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, PSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you, from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow, I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something.
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 40% site-wide. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I don't see that completely working. I see a modified system working.
One thing that kind of stood out to me was that first of all, any city, anywhere, they could send this report not as it relates to Bourbon Street, but almost to any city, anywhere, because you can do with unlimited resources everything, you know, pretty much to make it absolutely secure lockdown. That comes with the loss of some things as well. And the other thing I thought of, Aaron, was that New Orleans is a nice destination for people, especially location for the Super Bowl because of its compactness, because you can walk from here to there. You don't have to get on a bus or a car and drive 40 miles like you would in California here to there to another thing or other cities. And I just wonder if this report would not be better suited to anywhere USA as opposed any big city USA as opposed to New Orleans. That's what kind of stood out to me. We'll get your thoughts when we come back. 820 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL. The Teneo report, the company of which Bill Bratton is a member, has come out about recommendations, number of things to improve security in New Orleans, including closing Bourbon Street to traffic. Aaron Holmes is our guest, executive director of the View Create Property Owners, Residents, and Associates, VCPORA. And Aaron, you have a master's in urban planning, do you not, from UNO?
I do.
So you know what it takes, and it's not just, you know, a volunteer thing with you, and that you just let me put it this way. You know what you're talking about. That's what I'm trying to clumsily say. With all that,
I like to think I do.
Yeah. With all that being said, as it relates to my thoughts earlier, that this plan would apply nicely to any big city USA. Maybe not so much New Orleans because of the compact nature of it. And also, it's always a trade-off. You can, like a builder building anything, it's like, you got the money, I can do anything you want. And it's the same thing when it comes to locking down a city or making it absolutely secure. Thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, I was thinking about that during the break. You know, it does feel like this was not really tailored for New Orleans. Of course, there's references to Bourbon Street and the parades on St. Charles. But if you think about it, you can't bubble wrap this city because people have a tendency to gather. And it's just the natural way of New Orleans. So if it wasn't Bourbon Street or the Uptown Parade route, it could be any of 100 other sites where you're going to have a congregation of people. And we have such a strong festival season, and just your everyday kind of joie de vivre, your people are going to be outside, and essentially you're always going to have a target. That being said, you know, when they're looking at Bourbon Street and they're essentially saying, shut it down and you guys go figure out how to do this. Well, you have businesses that say, I can't limit my vendor deliveries between a narrow window. And furthermore, the plan actually recommends a closure of the pedestrian mall on Bourbon Street, which is an entire block outside of what is considered the entertainment district. So you have a block from St. Anne to Dumaine that is entire. It's zoned residential, and it's about half residential, half businesses. And so this plan is basically saying that those residents that live on that block, well, they can't access their homes ever again through a vehicle. So it's not really taking into account the nature, the reality of New Orleans, of the French Quarter, and how we choose to live.
And that's why I wanted to bring out the fact that you have a master's in urban planning from UNO, because it's not just a New Orleanian that lives in the quarter that has an opinion on this. That there's some education to back it, I guess is what I'm saying. And that did jump out at me at the report that, okay, this is pretty much common knowledge. You can make anything safe if you want, but I don't know that it's necessarily, as you said, tailored to New Orleans other than some references. Thoughts on, do you think you were, had enough of a voice in the process? Did they contact you or people that you know to ask what you would like to see or not? Or was it done strictly on their side?
I would say the latter. To be honest, even in the report, they mentioned that they had three separate closed door meetings. Mm-hmm. And within these meetings, you know, of course, the first meeting was with the, you know, the administration, the top brass. And the two subsequent meetings were invitation only, and they were extended to business owners along Bourbon Street and maybe a couple on Royal. But I did attend the third one, and frankly, I snuck in. Mm-hmm. But I I noted that there was definitely a lack of voices from other stakeholders in the French Quarter. The residents, number one, but businesses that would be impacted that maybe not work just on Bourbon Street. And then you have the workers' voices. And then, of course, as I learned later, there was a big commotion about Royal Street coming from the street performers, based on a rumor that went out that said that Royal Street should be closed. So what we did was we went to NOPD and we said we really need to have another meeting, a public meeting, so that people can understand what's being proposed. And we did have a meeting about a week ago, a little bit more than a week ago. And that was an interesting meeting as well, because I think about 250 people showed up. Mm-hmm. But at this point, the report had already been finished and given to the city. It just hadn't been shared yet.
I think the fact that you had to sneak in speaks volumes. Thank you, Aaron Holmes, Executive Director of the Vieux-Carré Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. And y'all remember, when you go to the French Quarter Festival this weekend, that it's a neighborhood as well as a tourist attraction or an attraction for locals. 8:30, we come back, we'll talk to Mandy Landry. Some bills that she's pre-filed for the session that starts next week seem to make sense to me. We'll talk to her when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News.
Baseball's number one digital destination is the MLB app. And this app's got game. Like game highlights, live games, fantasy games, and more.
A gem of a game!
This is baseball your way. With stats, scores, breaking news, and daily custom content that hits every time.
A monster shot!
Because here, you choose the teams and pick the players you want to follow.
All year long.
So when they catch it on the field,
what a catch!
You catch it on the MLB app. Download today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House of the Home Theater sounds appealing. But that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. But there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I don't get in the red line or the blue line or judge any individual based on either their party affiliation or the way they conduct themselves or carry themselves. I don't think everything A does is good or bad because he's A. I don't think everything B does is good or bad because he or she is a Democrat. With that, we welcome in Mandy Landry, a Louisiana state representative who is a Democrat. And it seems as though, and it is the reason I said that, Mandy, that fiscal responsibility used to be, or at one point was, a Republican issue. And it seems as though you as a Democrat are kind of concerned with that and where the tax dollars are going and how effectively they're being used. Accurate with some of the bills you pre-filed?
Oh, yes. I mean, a budget, whether you're a family or a state, tells you what your priorities are. And some of our money is not going in the right places, or we don't even know where it's going. I think you might be talking about the tax audit bill. Is that right?
Yeah, you can talk about all of them. I think refer to that. Even the ESA students with taking the same tests as public school students. You want to see if the money's being spent effectively, right?
And that's a big one. People probably have heard about, we're going to have these education savings accounts, which is not what they are. And it's going to be basically cash to give to people to send their kids to private school.
Wait, go slow. Take me back to that. These education savings accounts, what does it wind up being legally?
So over a few years, they're going to phase in different income levels, but it's going to essentially be a flat amount. It's going to be like $6,000 or $7,000, something like that, more for special needs kids. And you apply for it and you get the cash to send your kid to Catholic school, school.
And to be clear, anywhere. The governor announced this at Rummel High School.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. Okay, but go ahead.
it's very interesting. And, you know, there are some issues with it. The number one factor being it's tax money going to private and parochial schools with absolutely no parameters on it. But a lot of the issue is the legislature, the governor, are given this money and they're not checking on how it's being spent. And to me, how they're not checking is they're not going to be giving these kids the same test that public school kids have to take to make sure they're reading at grade level. We just had all those, you know, great improvements in reading and some in math. And ironically, people think our public schools are doing poorly. They're not. They're doing pretty good. Orleans and Jefferson Parish have a lot to improve in, but they are improving year by year. And if the kids in the private schools aren't taking these tests, we don't know how they're doing. And we do know right now kids who receive vouchers are not doing better than public school kids. At best, they're doing the same. So we need to put some accountability, regardless of where you are on that policy, and I have different views than many people, we need to make sure that the schools are actually preparing these kids.
What you're saying is, to make an analogy, let's go to the video replay booth and see how this actually turns out, right? Or what actually happens,
yeah.
What actually happened as a result of it. Is it any different than that?
No, that's not. Why keep running the same play if we know it's not working? But we don't have a video camera here, I guess would be the analogy that you gave me. We don't know. We have no way of knowing if we don't make these kids take the same tests as our public school kids.
And all you're talking about is taking a look, doing a review, and making equal to see who's doing well and who's not doing well and what's working and what's not. Let me take a break. We come back. We'll talk about tax credits, tax exemptions, HB 535 that you pre-filed. Mandy Landry, our guest. The legislative session convenes on Monday at noon, and it gavels out, hopefully, no later than 6 o'clock on Thursday, June 12th, 2025. We'll talk about Mandy's pre-filed bill, some other things that's got Representative Landry's attention. 850, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 856, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mandy Landry, state representative, about her pre-filed bills for the session that's coming up. Mandy, somebody texted in and said, let me get this straight. My tax dollars are going into the pocket of someone else to send their kid to a private school.
Yes.
Okay. Well, there you go. Let's talk
bluntly,
about...
yes. And you and I don't have kids in school, and
no? It's
going to public school and Catholic school kids, and you know what? That's fine. I support public education. We want our kids to be literate and smart.
It'd be nice to pay for everything for everybody, but sometimes it's not always possible. Let's talk about HB 535. Tell me what all that's about.
Is that the teachers or the – I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Get on your staff about this. That's about the legislative auditor to examine tax credits, tax exemptions. Yeah, if only we had a staff, right?
Sorry. I have like 12 bills. Every year – I mean, for years, we have a lot of these – programs that say if you just come here and do this, we'll give you a tax credit. If you hire 10 people, we'll give you a tax credit. If you do this, you'll get a tax deduction, et cetera, et cetera. And nobody, I don't want to say nobody, but it's not, the state doesn't follow up as much as it should. So this would create a department in the legislative auditor solely tasked with following up everyone who is in these programs, every organization in these programs. And this looks to be moving along with a lot of people liking it because there's a lot of money being wasted there.
So this doesn't matter whether it's the film industry, whether it's the Hunty steel plant, which is yet to break ground, and we don't know when that's going to happen, or something that's going to happen, or it would be hard to tell with something that's going to happen, but things that have already been created. Look, let's be honest. Politicians love to say, Democrat and Republican, that they created jobs. And my question started with the film industry a long time back in the tax credits is, well, are they really bringing jobs to Louisiana, or are we merely subsidizing jobs with taxpayer money? And that, in essence, is what you're looking to find out, right?
Kind of. I mean, I'm a huge supporter of the film industry, and that
different. And
I'm not saying that
it's not good. I'm just saying that. If you're going to question credits to one, you got to question credits to all.
Oh, of everyone to see if they're doing what they promised, if they're still ramping up, if it's working, if they need a little help, you know, just to see what's going on. Because right now, only so much is happening, but to have an entire department in the legislative auditor just looking at this would, I think, really go through a lot of this history that no one's looked at. And maybe we can move that money elsewhere.
And let's talk about taxes.
Yeah, this is my favorite bill, I think, by far. The legislature implemented a flat tax, which very, very dated. Everyone pays 3% now. As of about 4 or 5 years ago, you had your top 1% paying 6%. If we move our top 1%, literally 1% of returns, which is people who make $500,000 or more a year, which is not me or you, we would have $400 million to give teachers huge raises. Yep.
All right. Anything that's got your attention that you're just staunchly opposed to so far that's been pre-filed? We only have 20 seconds.
We're still going through. There's some interesting things, some really interesting things. And there's a lot of DEI and anti-immigrant stuff. And there is a member who wants to make chemtrails illegal. And if you don't know what that is,
yeah. You
should go Google it.
Yeah. But and hopefully some serious talk about insurance, both auto and homeowners.
Yes, there will be. I'll be back to talk to you.
Thank you, Mandy. Appreciate your time. Representative Mandy Landry, graduate of Blank, Notre Dame and Georgetown Law. When we come back, we're going to talk about kids and ACL injuries. And off we go into the 10 o'clock hour, 9:09 now. And I noticed on Twitter earlier that Thomas More, Thomas, thinking of Sir Thomas More, Thomas Morehead tweeted that he was looking for a flag football team for his son because apparently there's a waiting list or something. We met him Super Bowl week, and he is just a tremendously nice man. He tweeted, "My son Beckett got waitlisted for FNA flag football. He really wants to play. Anyone playing LaSalle, Uptown, or City Park with an open roster spot. He's currently 9 years old. Thanks. I guess it's first come, first served, and you want to give everybody an equal chance. But passing on Thomas Morstead's son? Really? I wouldn't do it." Speaking of kids and sports, Xavier Thompson joins us now, an assistant professor at the LSU School of Kinesiology, a leading expert in sports medicine. Good morning. I guess it's Dr. Thompson, and it doesn't tell me here, but I would.
Good morning.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes, it is.
You an orthopedist?
No, so I have a PhD in kinesiology.
PS, so that would be akin to a physical therapist or not?
Not really. Not exactly. So I am an athletic trainer by trade, actually. So there's a little bit of overlap, but our skill sets are a little different. So physical therapists, some work in sports, but they work in geriatrics too, whereas athletic trainers, we typically work with active individuals, whether that's your typical athlete, military setting, but we work in acute injury care, rehab, and pretty much we're the hub of the wheel when it comes to sports medicine.
I wasn't trying to cross-examine you. I just didn't have the information. I was just wondering. You're a leading expert in sports medicine at LSU. Let's put it that way. So, you know, I mentioned Thomas Morstead's son looking for a place to play flag football. He tweeted that. So many kids are involved in baseball and soccer, and now a lot of sports go year-round, basketball. What is going on with ACL and young people? And I guess specifically female athletes seem to be at a higher risk. At least I knew that was – traditionally I knew female athletes were at a higher risk of ACL tears and also a higher risk of concussions. They were the most dangerous sport was girls' soccer, right?
Yeah, so soccer is a big one. Cheerleading, too, to be honest. Most people don't think of it, but, you know, you're getting thrown in the air and can be pretty violent.
And catching, too, I guess, right?
Yeah, got to be caught. A lot of it, like you said, is you got kids going year-round and sometimes in the same sport doing the same thing over and over and over again. So they're not really developing like we used to back in the day where we had a lot of different movements. So we kind of learned how to adapt in different settings. And, yeah, women are 2 to 8 times as likely as men to tear their ACL.
Why is that?
So some of it is, you know, differences in how their pelvises are shaped, particularly post-puberty, but some of it's also just exposure to training. The infrastructure for women's sports is growing more and more, but it's not necessarily the same place as it is with our powerhouse sports like football, basketball, and baseball in the same way that it has been for men for far longer. So the training hasn't been as great historically, but it's definitely on its way up, and we're really looking into things like that, differences in hormones, biology, sleep, all of it.
When it comes to kids in participation in sports. I don't know if it matters whether it's girl or boy, but it seems like a lot of people, and I noticed this just at the driving range on the golf course, Xavier, and that's people got their kids out there because everybody now is looking for a golf scholarship for the kids.
Yeah.
And it's a fact. And I don't know if the same thing is happening in baseball, football, basketball, soccer, et cetera.
Yeah.
But even sometimes that means kids have personal trainers. That means they never have any time off. And I'm just wondering if that's a factor in adding to ACL tears and all that, where there's just not enough rest or not enough time off.
Yeah. I mean, you're spot on. And I think more and more we see that search for the elusive athletic scholarship, or, you know, and not necessarily coming from a bad place. We all want the best for our kids. I have kids, but we get so focused sometimes on being, you know, a baseball player, a basketball player. And like you said, we got a personal trainer, and that's all we do year round. We get burnt out. We get focused on being that one thing, and we develop, I'd say, kids with Ferrari engines, but we don't necessarily give them the infrastructure to be able to use that in the right way. Whereas before it was, hey, play a little bit of this, play a little bit of that, be a kid, just go to the playground, or maybe take some time off and rest.
How hard is it? And I've had two knee replacements and had numerous knee surgeries before that and went through the rehab process for all of that. How is it different for a kid than an adult?
Great. So kids aren't little adults, and I think we lose sight of that because we know so much of what to do, and we exercise. We should do this. We should do that. They're still growing and developing their bones, their ligaments, their tendons. So there's going to be, you know, literal growing pains, but also figurative ones where we have to let them figure out their coordination, and we also have to make sure they enjoy what they're doing. And for us, sometimes it's, you know what, I'm not pushing myself hard enough, but we're physically mature. We can kind of push through. Sometimes that check engine light for a kid is a little different, where their body's telling you, like, hey, we need to back up. Because, yes, they recover faster, you know, in certain ways, but they're also not as resilient in others, and that's by design.
I've seen, you know, having been to numerous physical therapy sessions with all the knee troubles, thankfully all that, knock wood, is all behind me, but it amazed me to see the young kids that were there in all different sports. And I don't know, you know, I didn't even know about physical therapy until I was an adult and started tearing, I realized that I had torn my knees up. But is that a new thing with, are more and more kids going to physical therapy than ever before? And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but there is a cause and effect relationship there, right?
Yes. And I think part of it, and I've worked in physical therapy clinic before, I think sometimes you see kids who they're there because they're not active at all. And I think that is just, you know, generational change, where we have kids who are inside all the time, iPads, and we have the other extreme where we have kids who are too active all the time. You know, if we put it on a bell curve, there is a happy medium. And, you know, if your kid isn't active at all and they're having pains or they're having trouble moving, depending on what's going on, that might be a way to go. And I've seen that. But also, if your kid is playing tennis, you know, 12 months a year and their elbow hurts, we also see that extreme as well.
I was talking earlier about taking a lot of ibuprofen because, you know, I'm not 30 years old, Doc. Let's just leave it at that. And I love to work out. I love to hit the elliptical machine. But, man, there are a lot of aches and pains, a lot of numbness in the hands from pinched nerves, these kind of things. But I'm an older guy, so I accept that. But when it comes to kids, once they tear an ACL, how prone are they? Because you got to look beyond being a kid, right? Because not everybody's going to be a professional athlete. Even if you go to college on a scholarship, you're not going to be a professional athlete. How concerned are you, as one of the leading experts in sports medicine at LSU, that we're raising a generation of kids, or a generation of kids is being raised, that are going to suffer for the rest of their life with a lot of physical conditions? They're charging up the physical, the credit card tab now, and they're going to pay for it later. How concerned are you about that?
Oh, very, very. And that was one of my big concerns when I worked clinically. That's one of my big concerns now. If you tear your ACL and you stay active, more than 20%, more than one out of every five people are going to do it again. And every time you do that, I mean, we've already talked about the hard recovery process. you're looking at quite a bit of time away from your sport or whatever it is you care about, even if it's not sport, you know, just being active, feeling normal. And honestly, it also accelerates the rate of osteoarthritis. So you're looking at kids who are relatively healthy, young people who 5 years later, we're already putting them at risk for having arthritis of their knees, where otherwise, you know, you'd expect them to have a normal, healthy 20, 25, 30-year-old knee.
So you're talking about a 30-year-old with arthritis is what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Like Fred Sanford with his arthritis, but Fred Sanford was 67 years old.
Exactly. And, you know, like you said, we're putting them at risk for, you know, lifelong issues if we don't address this issue.
Somebody texted in, my daughter is a 16, 17-year-old teammate, tore her ACL last season, doesn't say what sport. I got her repaired and rehabbed very well. 1 or 2 months back into playing fully, she has re-torn the same ACL. So hard for these athletes to deal with this at high school age. There is, yes. If you tear your ACL, there is a high likelihood, as you just said, that you're going to tear it again?
Yes. Yes, there is. And injury prevention is one of the strangest things in the field because, you know, how do you successfully prove that you prevented someone from tearing, mm-hmm. from having an injury? But rehab is getting better and better. I think the thing that I've always preached to my athletes and people I work with is a little bit of patience. So I think we saw, you know, back in the day, moving into the early 2010s, we got to this place where it's like, accelerate the rehab. And my message was always like, hey, let's do it right. And that doesn't mean it might not be relatively fast, but, you know, let's make sure we do it right. And it's complicated. You know, you got to get strong. You essentially have to reteach your knee how to move. And to be honest, I think the biggest thing people don't realize is once you hurt your knee or really any joint, you have to reteach your brain how to use the muscle and that joint, and it's a complicated process.
Let's pick it up there when we come back, Doctor, okay, and we'll compare and contrast young people with adults. We're talking to Dr. Xavier Thompson. He's a leading expert in sports medicine at LSU, and we're talking about ACL injuries. And matter of fact, somebody texted in about what's the ACL. We'll talk about that. The MCL, also about meniscus tears, or as other people refer to it, torn cartilages. And when it comes to cartilage, I don't think people realize that when you tear a cartilage, as it stands now, and you can correct me when we come back if I'm wrong, they don't cure anything. They just go in and cut out the bad part. Unless anything's changed, I think that's where we are. If you have any questions or comments about knee injuries, young people, athletes, elbows, shoulders, etc., Dr. Xavier Thompson's here. Text your questions in to 504-260-1870. That is the Oakland Heart Jeweler talk and text line. And I should tell you, I believe, after my training yesterday, that message and data rates may apply and don't text and drive. So there you go. We'll be back in a flash, WWL. Talking to Dr. Xavier Thompson, a leading expert in sports medicine at LSU. We're talking about kids and not having enough time off playing sports year-round. ACL injuries, and somebody texted in about their daughter's teammate, soccer player, tore the ACL and then re-tore it this year. We talked about females being more prone to torn ACLs for a couple of different reasons. And, doctor, I just wanted to go quickly into MCL, mm-hmm. ACL, and meniscus. I said earlier that when it comes to meniscus, a torn cartilage, they don't fix it. They just cut the bad part out. Is that accurate?
Most of the time, yeah. For a meniscus, if they also tore their ACL, depending on where their chair is, if you have time, they might try to fix it. But those are the two primary options. But other cartilage, no. They usually just take it out.
And that means what, long-term?
Long-term, essentially you're removing that cushion from your knee, which is probably going to, you know, lead to some pains long-term, some arthritis, and potentially, not be great for you.
So you are leading expert sports medicine at LSU. You have kids. You're a parent. What would you advise parents when it comes to kids if they're either trying to live out their own dreams through their kids, they want the best for their kids? Look, I played high school football, got the bejeebers knocked out of me because I was a tackling dummy, but I still learned some lessons from it. What would you tell parents the best way to manage their kids' sports I won't say career, because you don't want to be a career at their age, but their sports activities, Doc?
I'd say, you know, take a deep breath. Be patient. I think right now we're all so focused on going fast and looking around and trying to get here and there. And I've worked with professional athletes, and funny enough, those are usually the ones who didn't take it too seriously as kids, the ones who found the joy, got the opportunities to just play, grow, learn. And more of the research on actual, you know, pro athletes from around the world is showing most of them, honestly, weren't the ones who were pushed really hard by their parents. It's normally that internal drive who were just kind of allowed to grow and explore. Keep them active, keep them healthy, and, you know, just try to guide them down the path.
I think part of it, too, is some people, you can't work your way into being a professional athlete. It's nice to think that, but a professional athletic ability is something I believe you're born with or you aren't. Now, you can develop that, but I don't think you're going to make anybody into a professional athlete. Accurate?
Well, yeah, I mean, great point. And that hit me in college. And, you know, I was one of those, I'm working really hard. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends pointed out an athlete we were working with. And he said, Xavier, he's 6'4", running a 4.4 in 225 pounds. I was never going to be there.
Right.
And that was an eye-opener, like you said. I mean, there is a big genetic component. And, you know, it hurts because you want to believe, work hard, you can do anything. And you can do a lot of things if you work hard. And I think you can maximize your specific ability. But, you know, don't get so caught up in, I need to make a pro athlete, that you lose the joy of the process and just letting them have fun doing what they enjoy, whether that's sports or not.
And along those lines, I should say, you know, I once arm wrestled a guy that was not really big or muscular or anything, but it's one of these guys that just, I say they have muscles that are made of steel, like steel cable. They're just naturally strong. My arm was sore for a year because I don't have muscles that are made of steel cable. Some people are built differently and are less prone to injury, right? So if you try to force the funk or fake whatever, it's, you could be leading to more serious injuries for your kid when they're not actually physically inclined to tolerate that kind of activity. Accurate or not?
Exactly. Accurate. And you know what? And sometimes it's just they're not ready right now. You know, your 5-year-old isn't a 7-year-old, isn't a 12-year-old. Sometimes you just have to recognize where they are developmentally and take a step back. Even if that kid was is you know, genetically gifted and going to be an amazing pro athlete, they are still a kid.
Doctor, I appreciate your time and your insight. I hope you come back sometime because I could talk to you about this hours, okay?
I appreciate you having me. I love the opportunity.
Thank you, sir, because I think it's important. I think a lot of people, and I just see it, you know, I don't have kids at soccer or anything like that. I don't see that, but I do go to driving range, and it seems like, man, every afternoon they got kids, parents dragging their kids out there and pushing them, hoping for a college scholarship, and I see it all the time, and I don't know that you can tear anything up playing golf, but I would imagine the same thing is going on in other sports. Dr. Xavier Thompson, leading expert sports medicine at LSU. If you missed any of it, you can download the Odyssey app, use the rewind feature, or go to WWL.com, click on my name. But don't do it now, because we're going to talk about tariffs with professor of economics at Boston University when we come back. Right now, time for traffic on WWL. It is 9:40, 20 till 10, and a lot of time. First of all, I kind of chuckle when I hear people all excited and breathless about the stock market opening here or up or down, because yesterday, happy days are here again, until around mid-afternoon, then the market finished down again. We always also confuse and conflate sometimes terms that we hear and use them interchangeably when maybe that's not necessarily the case, and we might be mistaken in the way we use them. And specifically, we're talking about trade deficit, whether that's necessarily a negative thing as it relates to tariffs or not. And our guest is Tarek Hassan, professor of economics at Boston University. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hi, good morning.
Let's talk about trade deficits and trade surpluses and their relations to tariffs, and jump in where you feel comfortable on this big, long question, because a lot of times we think that trade deficit, that's not good, but that's not necessarily the case economically, is it?
Yeah, not at all. So at a basic level, it just means we're getting more stuff from abroad than we're sending abroad. That sounds maybe not so bad, right? So we're getting more things from the world. It's sort of a poorly named concept. Essentially, the way that you figure a trade deficit is actually the exact opposite of an investment surplus. So the only way...
Yeah, go slow here, Doc. Hang on a second. Go slow.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So the only way slow for us to have a trade deficit mm-hmm. is to have an investment surplus. And those are actually the same things. So what that means is that the only way for us to get all these extra goods from abroad, that's happening because foreigners are investing a lot more in the U.S. than we are investing abroad.
But now, wait, now, explain that to me, because people hear what you say and they say, no, that's not true. If foreign companies are investing in the United States and manufacturing products abroad and we're bringing them in, so that's not investment. Explain that, if you will, please.
So in the U.S., we are kind of exceptional because we have kind of the most stable currency in the world, the U.S. dollar, and we are kind of the incubator of companies for the entire world. So people come to the U.S. to start their companies, foreigners, like Elon Musk is a great example of this. Mm-hmm. He was born in South Africa, came to the U.S. to start his company. So then it's only natural that foreigners who started the companies in the U.S. are also buying shares in these companies. So investment is flowing into the U.S. at a very high rate. And because that is happening, we can take that money that we're getting from abroad and buy more goods with it. So these are actually the same things. It makes no sense to say we want a trade deficit and we also want foreigners to invest in the U.S. That's not how it works. So either you have foreigners investing in the U.S., then you have a trade. That means, or you have a trade surplus. You can't have both at the same time.
So when it comes to the argument that people want everything manufactured here and we should import nothing, economically, you would respond to that how?
I mean, so that is a very dangerous thing. Because, you know, we are a small part of the world economy. We're 15% of the world economy. If we were to wall ourselves off from the rest of the world, we would just get poorer. You just saw this with Brexit. The Brits kind of tried it, and it cost them like 6% of their national income. So that's a very dangerous idea. I think the problem is that we're conflating two things that are not directly connected. One is the trade deficit, and the other is manufacturing. These two things... You know, tariffs are not like a magical way for bringing manufacturing back. The reason manufacturing disappears is largely technological. There's been a lot of technological progress in how to make things, and you just need fewer people for that now. What's happening with all the capital inflows that we're having? So what the trade deficit is doing is it's bringing a lot of foreign money into the U.S., and that's going into all kinds of branches of the economy, and not necessarily manufacturing. So the reason we have low interest rates compared to the rest of the world is because we're importing so much capital, because there's so much investment from abroad in the U.S.
They're
just not investing in manufacturing. They're investing in other things.
I'm sorry. I think I heard the president say yesterday, or his spokesperson, that tariffs have already brought $2 billion into the country, into the Treasury. And look, McKinley started tariffs as a revenue-raising measure, not about production or manufacturing or anything else. He did it because it was, in essence, a glorified sales tax, right?
Yeah, it's a sales tax, but, you know, sort of we teach our undergrads that there's different ways of taxing, and some are more damaging than others. Tariffs are a very damaging way of taxing the consumer, as we're all about to find out. You know, wait a couple of weeks and then go to Walmart and see what happened to prices there. Essentially, everything that you see in Walmart is basically being blanketed. Everything except the food is being blanketed with massive tariffs. So you're going to see prices of these things going up. Now, I'm not sure we want to finance the U.S. government with taxes specifically on goods that are purchased by low-income people. Yeah, that's essentially what's being proposed here. And in fact, you know, the reason, you know, 150 years ago, the federal government was financing itself with tariffs because it was unable to do anything else. Mm-hmm. As soon as it learned to do income taxation, it did income taxation. There's a reason for this, because it's a much fairer way of financing the government.
Leaving politics out of it, compare and contrast, if you will, the state of the world economy when McKinley had tariffs and today's economy. And I only use McKinley as a reference, a historical reference. I'm not making it about politics or personalities or party or anything else. I'm just talking about the economics of it, the world economy, how it's different from back in that day.
So here's the big difference. So it used to be that the only thing that you would ship would be basically a finished product, more or less, mm-hmm. right? Now, U.S. manufacturing relies very strongly on imported inputs. So if you wanted to really bring back manufacturing, you wouldn't tax the import of things that you need to make things. So 2/3 of our imports are you know, things that we need to build U.S. manufactured goods. So, so 2/3 of what we import, like, is needed to make other things. So what you're doing by putting these tariffs up is you're damaging U.S. manufacturing, far from helping it. And that's why you see the stock prices of all these manufacturing firms going down. I mean, this is really done in like the dumbest possible way. This is politics aside.
No, I understand that.
I
hear you. It's counterintuitive, and some people are going to hear it politically, and I don't want them to, because we're just trying to establish what's real, what's not here. So you're saying what's manufactured here, 2/3 of the materials used are imported. So if anything...
Two-thirds of imports. So about 10% of GDP is just like stuff that we bring in to like put into cars that we're assembling here, or into washing machines that we're assembling here, or into computer screens that we're assembling here, right? So if you now kind of tell U.S. manufacturers, you have to compete in the world market, but we're tying both arms behind your back by saying you are not allowed to use anything from abroad, well, that's a competitive disadvantage. And we're going to see this in prices of U.S. manufactured goods going up as well.
I like to bring the audience into it. Somebody texted in and said, doesn't make sense. I thought selling your products worldwide was the target. Selling goods equates to income. Am I right? So it's a good thing that America takes in global products at a much higher rate than what America sells. Got it. I guess they're agreeing with you there?
I would say yes, because we're like, it's not like we're, we're very good as an economy in sort of producing what I would call financial assets. Mm-hmm. So that means for many different reasons, foreigners are very glad to either invest directly in the U.S. by buying stocks or kind of starting companies, or buying debt of U.S. consumers and U.S. companies. So basically what the trade deficit is doing is it's lowering interest rates for all of us.
Let me ask you this. Usually, and I know the car business, having done so many remotes there in radio, usually the best salesman in the place is the finance guy. And I'm just wondering if maybe that's what you're saying, where an equivalency would be. The U.S. makes its money in the currency and in the financing, not in the production of products necessarily. Is that what we're saying?
Exactly. Okay. So, you know, manufacturing is about 12% of the U.S. economy. So most people who have jobs in the U.S. are actually not manufacturing stuff. They're doing other things. Mm-hmm. And we are just better at those other things. One of those other things that we're much better at is like just having a reliable government and a reliable framework where like you don't need to worry that like people are going to you invest money somewhere and then they kind of say, oh, it's not yours anymore. So we provide like safe assets for the world. Yes. And a lot of that is banking. I agree with that. So we're kind of the banker for the world in some sense.
So somebody wants to know, how do we reduce the ties of production to foreign adversaries? How do we become self-reliant? Is that a practical consideration in a world economy that we have today?
So it is practical. I just want to emphasize that it's very costly. So it might not feel like it, but the U.S. economy has actually grown tremendously compared to other countries in the last 20 years. Like, we've pulled way ahead of Europe. We're the richest country in the world by a long stretch. And, part of the reason we are so rich is because we take stuff from all over the world, ideas, inputs, physical things and ideas, and we put them together in different ways. And then we sell it back to the world. That's essentially what I would describe the U.S. economy as doing. Now, if you want to be self-sufficient, you're cutting all of that off, and that's a large chunk of our wealth. So, yes, maybe we want to be self-sufficient on a few things that we need for defense. And I think that's fine. Then you need to talk about sort of tariffs on very specific things, like, maybe semiconductors or, tariffs. I mean, you're not allowed to export like bombs to whoever you want anyway. So we're doing like that's been the practice for a long time.
Professor, let me get this in real quick before we run out of time. Yeah, and that is, can I infer from what you're saying that with the tariffs and if we have to pay higher labor costs in the United States to produce stuff, that in essence, this could lead to manufacturers that are currently producing stuff in the United States to take their business offshore?
Or just shutting down. I think that's the bigger thing. Like, so car manufacturers in Detroit, the Detroit area, have already laid off people for the very simple reason that the reason these plants are competitive is because they get some of their inputs from Canada. And now these inputs have become more expensive and they're just not making the cars. And that means that the cars that are getting made are going to get more expensive and people are going to buy fewer cars. The economy is not a zero sum game, right? So a lot of this discussion is like, are we going to make the car here or are we going to make it in Mexico? Well, what we're going to end up with is we're just going to make fewer cars in the world, period. And that's just another way of saying we're getting poorer. So people have done the math. Like, essentially, the impact of all these tariffs on the U.S. economy will be making all of us 4% poorer. So, and you're going to see that in inflation going up. So we're going to get inflation of prices are going to go up and wages not.
Professor, I appreciate your time. I hope we talk to you again in a couple of weeks when some of this starts to hit, all right?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Tarek Hassan, professor of economics at Boston University, 9:54, 6 till 10. Quick break, then we'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today here on WWL.